this morning to Ephesians chapter 5. We'll be studying from that context, Ephesians chapter 5. It is a blessing to be with you. We do have some who are visiting with us, and we're always glad when you are here. And certainly we want to keep in mind in our prayers to God those who are having a hard time right now. And Lord willing, they'll be back with us as soon as possible. We have been involved in a short series of lessons along the line of what children can learn from their parents. And what we have found is there are some tremendously powerful lessons, either for good or for bad, that our children can learn from us as their parents. We noticed in the first lesson that our example can impact our children's faith, their values, their morals, their zeal for God, even their spiritual priorities, and really looked at it from a pretty generic standpoint as far as the impact that our example and our teaching in our lives can have. And then we progressed last week to begin to look at our marriages. What do our parents learn, or what do our children learn from their parents about marriage and about the values of marriage and the principles of marriage that not only help them regarding their future concepts of marriage itself, but also some concepts about God. What are they learning from us? And so last week what we began to look at was the value and the power of respect and submission in the marriage relationship. Noticing there in Ephesians 5 verse 21, there's a sense in which both a husband and a wife to submit to one another's needs. Now, in peculiar senses, in particular senses, there certainly is a diversity of function. And we're going to talk about the idea of sacrificial headship this morning. But what we found out last week as we were studying together is that really when we talk about submission, you cannot be a faithful Christian, whether you're a man or a woman, and embrace Christianity and not understand submission, the idea of submitting to God, submitting to our shepherds or pastors in a local congregation, even submitting to one another in a generic sense. And notice there in Ephesians 5:21, right before it begins this major section regarding marriage illustrating Christ and the church, and that's really what he's trying to get to. In verse 21, he says, "Be subject or submit to one another in the fear of Christ because of your reverence to Christ." And so what we talked about last week is the fact that while he tells a woman to submit to her husband, it begins with her reverence for Christ, her submission to Christ. And the same is true of all submission, whether you're talking about the submission of a woman to her husband in a godly way, or the submission of citizens to the government, as Romans chapter 13 teaches, or the submission of members to their shepherds. And I would even say this, and we tried to point this out last week, that even those in positions of authority or leadership have to submit to the needs of those over whom they are leading, or whom they are leading. And so that's an important principle found there in Ephesians 5:21. And so we talked about respectful submission. As a godly woman, as a godly mother, as a godly wife, are your children seeing those very valuable principles of respectful submission and what that means in your home and how that should impact them? But we're going to talk about loving leadership this morning as we now progress to talk about the men. I promised the sisters last week that I would get to their husbands this week, and so we're going to do that. And really talk about the idea of loving leadership. Do our children, in how their fathers love their mothers, are they seeing loving leadership? That is sacrificial headship. Let's notice Ephesians chapter 5. I want to begin again with verse 22 just to get the flow of the context. In verse 22, he says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, and he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. I want you to notice before we progress, verse 32 again. By understanding our physical relationships, that illustrates important principles about our relationship with God. And so it's not just that you're teaching your children by your example in your marriage about marriage, even though that's very important. But you're also teaching them about Christ and the church in a sense. You're teaching them about their need to submit to God. You're teaching them the idea of a sacrificial head in Jesus Christ. And so often I think we try to compartmentalize our relationships. And so here's a godly woman and she thinks, well, I have this relationship with my husband and then I have this relationship with my children. And there are certainly some distinctions there, but my point to you is the family unit is a very dynamic relationship. And often our children are molding their thinking about more generic, deeper thoughts, such as headship and submission and obedience and love and compassion and forgiveness from what they see at home. Often it has been the case that I have found that when people obey the gospel who perhaps came out of a very difficult family relationship, they have to do more unwinding in their mind of wrong thoughts about who God is and who the Lord is and having a heavenly Father that truly loves them. And so the family unit is very important. Let's notice Ephesians 5 and verse 25. That's the context. We've read it. But let's begin as we think about the idea of loving leadership. And as I mentioned to you last week, there's a lot of misconceptions about submission and headship and that kind of thing. We dealt with the submission aspect last time. But as we learn about loving leadership, let's begin with what that entails in selfless love. Selfless love. Look there at verse 25. He says, he just commands, husbands, love your wives. Now that is significant. That being a command. Husbands, love your wives. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But I think there's a misconception that we have to address in our mind, especially in our culture. A lot of people have the idea that aren't married, by the way. I'll preface this. That there's some perfect person. And perhaps in their mind, there's this one ideal spouse for them. There is the ideal man for a young woman. Or the ideal woman. And they are almost perfect. And in your mind, quite perfect. And that if you could just find the perfect person. Now we'll say we know nobody's perfect. But if you could just find the perfect person, then you could have the perfect life and maybe the perfect job and the perfect relationship and the perfect marriage and life would just be wonderful. And you talk to married people and they just smile at you. They kind of shake their head. No, that's not exactly the way it is. But you still have this in mind. And then, because of that misconception, you marry. And maybe you think in your mind, you found the perfect guy. I mean, he walks and talks and acts just like you want him to. But not really. Because then you get married and you realize he really doesn't walk and talk and act just like you want him to. And so there's this idea, uh-oh, I didn't get the one. I didn't find that perfect husband. I didn't find that perfect wife. And now I'm so dissatisfied because somewhere out there, there would have been the perfect guy for you. And then life would have been grand. And that's all a myth. ladies and gentlemen, that's foolishness. Now, granted, there are some people more fit to have successful marriages than others. But none of us are perfect. There's no perfect man out there. There are faithful men. There are faithful Christian men. And there are faithful Christian women out there. And marriage can be a blessing. But even if you find that very faithful Christian, they're not perfect. They're not sinless. None of us are. And so we have to approach this with realistic expectations. And if you don't approach life and marriage with those kinds of expectations, then you'll have great disappointment. I've had people say, oh no, I married the wrong one. Well, congratulations, now they are the right one because you have married them. And instead of trying to find somebody else that can be the right one, before the God of heaven, they are the right one. And our ideas of love are interesting. Often when people talk about love, what they're really talking about is infatuation. You know that feeling you had when you first met the person? But that wasn't really love. It certainly was not agape love, as we read here in Ephesians 5. It wasn't what a husband is commanded to have. It may be a great feeling, but that feeling may only last for a while. And we're going to talk about what this love exactly is, but we have to get rid of some of the misconceptions to enjoy the blessing of marriage, because it transcends all of those superficial ideas that we might have. Well, let's talk about this love. Look there in verse 25. Let's define what he's talking about. He says, and he defines it for us, he says, husbands, love your wives. First of all, that's not just an emotional, emotive kind of feeling. A lot of times that's what we think we want. In fact, it's not infatuation at all. It's a command. You can't command somebody to be infatuated with somebody else. This is a command. He commands husbands to love their wives. Now, while sexual attraction and intellectual connection and common interest and friendship are all part of a successful marriage, this transcends those notions. Now, that may be hard for some of us to get our mind wrapped around, but this is far greater than those notions. This type of love is the most divine, intentional, intense, determined, magnanimous, a sacrificial, humble kind of love. It's a love of the will. It's a love you can have for your husband or wife even if they don't walk and talk just like you want them to. Even when they make grievous mistakes. It is someone willing to love another person. It is the closest thing to the love God has for us. Did God love you? Did He love me? Did He love us? Simply because He looked at us and admired us so greatly and we were so godly and righteous and holy? Certainly not. Romans 5, 6 through 8 says He commends His love or exhibited His love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. We were ungodly and Jesus gave Himself for us. That's agape love. It is the kind of love that led Christ to the cross. It is the kind of love John 3:16 speaks of, for God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. It's the kind of love that brethren are to have for one another. Do I just love my brother or sister in Christ when they do what I want them to do? No. Even when they don't do right, I still love them. I may not be able to accept their conduct, but I still love them. In Matthew 5:44, it's the love believers are to have for their enemies. And that might help your marriage sometime, but I don't know. But it's not just an emotional kind of up and down feeling. Now, it embraces your emotions. And I would say this, that husbands loving their wives is going to lead them to all the other kinds of love that they really ought to have. Whether it's sexual love or friendship or fondness, all of those good things. But this is you willing to love her, purposing to love her. And so at the very beginning, understanding this love is a selfless love. Look at verse 25. It says, husbands, love your wives as Christ also loved the church. That's a pretty tall order, isn't it? And all of us fall short of that sometimes. But that's the mark. That's the goal. And this defines the love that he mentions here. But that leads me, as we look at verse 25, to the next statement, which is very akin to the first one. And that is, not only is it a selfless love, it is a sacrificial love. It is a sacrificial love. In fact, not only is it a sacrificial love, it is a, in order to have this selfless love, which doesn't seem to be so natural to us because we tend to be very selfish people. So, you know, you're talking about selfless love. We tend to be those who are selfish. Now we're talking about sacrificial love. We tend to like for other people to sacrifice for us, but not so much for us to sacrifice for them. This is a sacrificial love, and I will tell you, it is a love we must learn. Again, notice what it says there in verse 25, that husbands are to love their wives, as Christ also loved the church. Keep reading. And gave himself up for her. Now, we've talked about headship. But I think a lot of men don't understand headship, just like a lot of women may not understand what it really means to be submissive. And people that aren't very familiar with the Bible, you know, the carnal man goes here to Ephesians 5 and he says, well, great, it says that my wife is to be subject to me as to the Lord. And as the husband, I'm the head of the wife. But they kind of stop right there. It says, as Christ is the head of the body. And it goes on to say, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. It is a learned love. We can only, and I want to make this point very clearly, and while I understood it in the past as I read through Ephesians 5, this is a point that really came home to me. We can only learn to love our wives ideally from Jesus Christ. The principles of how a husband is to love his wife is found perfectly in Jesus Christ. And so what I would say to young women, if you're seeking a man that will really, truly love you in the ultimate sense, you need to find not just somebody who got wet, not just somebody who was baptized, not just somebody who says they're a Christian. You need to find a man with character. You need to find someone to be your husband that knows what Jesus Christ did at Calvary. If he doesn't understand what Jesus Christ did at Calvary, there is zero chance that he'll fully comprehend sacrificial love. We learn this from Jesus Christ. So in Paul's view, wives give complete submission to complete love received from their husbands. Let me say that again. Submission will happen because she reverences Christ and she loves her husband. And certainly there are occasions when her husband may not be the greatest guy in the world. But from a husband's standpoint, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm saying to you is while she is to submit out of love, you are to lead out of love. You are to be her head out of love. As a wife sacrificially submits to her husband because of her reverence for Christ, so her husband is to sacrificially love and lead her in view of what Christ did. She may not always be exactly what he thought she should be, but he strives to lead. Kenneth Weiss writes the following. He says, the husband has three other kinds of love for his wife, a love of passion, a love of satisfaction, and fondness or affection. All these are saturated with the agape love of the Spirit-filled husband, purified and made heavenly in character. The best husbands are faithful Christians. And so as husbands, we embrace the idea of servant leadership. We read Philippians 2 regarding submission last week, but the same applies here. I want you to look at Matthew chapter 20 and verses 25 through 28. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 25. Jesus called them unto him and said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. In other words, they just lord it over them. What are elders told not to do? Now, they're in a position of authority and leadership, and they have to make decisions, and they have to shepherd and pastor. But what are they told not to do by Peter in 1 Peter chapter 5? Do not what over the flock? Do not lord it over the flock. That's not true leadership. And so that's what he's speaking of there. In verse 26, he says, "But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister or servant. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many." Sacrifice, and listen to me, husbands, sacrifice or sacrificial headship does not deny authority, it supports it. What does Philippians 2 say about Jesus as a result of his sacrifice? He was exalted. A man that is insecure with his own headship often will stick his chest out and tell you how he's the head of his wife. But he is not. Fred Renick, in a book about marriage, says this. He says, "The problem of wholesome relationships is complicated by our self-centeredness. Even a man's love for his wife is distorted by selfishness, so that his ideas about love focus on what he gets from loving her rather than what he gives to her. The answer to the seemingly hopeless barrier to husband-wife oneness has been demonstrated by Christ. Husbands, love your wives as Christ also loved the church." Sometimes it's hard to know. How do you love your wife? Look at how Christ loved the church. But that leads us to verses 26 and 27, going back to Ephesians 5. So it's a selfless love. It's a sacrificial love. But let's go further. It's a sanctifying love. Now remember, he speaks, and it's interwoven. He speaks of Christ loving the church. And so some of this language, especially in verses 26 and 27, has its primary application in Christ loving the church. But that teaches us about marriage as well. And he's told us that already. And so you have to run the parallels. He says that he's comparing the wife's submission to the church's submission to Christ. And then the other parallel would be a husband as a head trying to follow after the sacrificial headship of Jesus Christ and the leadership of Jesus Christ. And it's important to see this balance. The Bible doesn't teach a dictatorial kind of leadership. An abusive kind of leadership. People who try to argue that biblical headship is some kind of abusive headship don't understand what the Bible teaches and haven't taken the time to really look into the Scriptures. But I will tell you some of the current ideas, and you know, you hear people say, well, it's 50-50. That doesn't work. You both have to give your all. You each have distinct functions, but there has to be leadership. And it has been my experience that godly women should appreciate faithful leadership, especially faithful and sacrificial leadership. And if they appreciate that leadership from Christ, that will help them along the way appreciate a godly husband. Now, having said that, when you look at verses 26 and 27, let's keep going. We've got selfless headship. We've got sacrificial headship. And men, I really want you to notice verses 26 and 27 here. Here's what he says. He says, "Husbands, love your wives." Verse 25, "As Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her so that he might sanctify her." Why did he do this? Why did he give himself up for her? Have you given yourself up for your wife? Have you sacrificed yourself for your wife? You refusing to lead spiritually in your home and family is not giving yourself up for your wife. It's putting her in a very difficult situation. He says the reason he did this, the reason Christ gave himself up for the church, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all of her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. Let's talk about this. First of all, he says Christ sanctified his bride with redeeming love. There, you can't see it in the English, but in the Greek there is an introduction in order that three times in this text to make three points here. First of all, he wanted his people, he wanted the church to have pure condition. Know what it said, notice what it says. That he might sanctify her. The idea of sanctifying is the idea of setting apart or causing to be holy. He sanctified her for God's purposes, for divine purposes, for something that just transcended and went beyond a physical thing or a fleshly thing. He goes on further. We have that pure condition for God's purposes. But not only the pure condition, but he wants her to have a pure condition so she can have a pure presentation. This is interesting language. He says that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing. So this references the idea of splendor and moral completeness or moral perfection. Christ is very protective of his bride's purity. He doesn't want somebody else coming along and defiling her purity. He will protect her purity to the best of his ability. Notice some other passages quickly. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2 speaks of the church as Christ's bride. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. In fact, the Lord says there in that passage, Paul writing, he says, "For I am jealous over you with godly jealousy." I think what he's saying is, I'm protective of you. I care about you. I don't want you to be defiled. "For I have espoused you to one husband." So Paul is saying, I've taught you, but get the language. "I am jealous over you," he says, "with godly jealousy." That's Paul. "For I have espoused you to one husband that I may present you as a chaste or pure virgin to" who? Christ. You're a virgin or a bride for Jesus Christ. And so even as an apostle, I'm being protective of you. So you have a pure condition. You have a pure presentation to himself. You could also read Revelation 19, 7 through 9 says the same thing. You have a pure reputation. "But that she would be holy and blameless." In first century times, one of the common customs of Jewish women before they married was a cleansing, a washing, a bathing that was a ritual that was to indicate purity for her husband to be. Now let's apply this to husbands. If we're following the example of Christ, we need to have a selfless love, we need to have a sacrificial love. But this is one that's very vital. A sanctifying love. Jesus has a sanctifying love. And I know there's some aspects of his sanctification that we don't meet. Only the Lord can sanctify us in the sense of salvation. But still, there is this desire on his part to sanctify his wife. Let me back up before you marry, because some of you are dating. If you're dating a young man, or you're dating a young woman, and you get the line that "I love you, and because I've now told you that I love you, this is what I would like for us to do," but the problem is what they want you to do will cause you to become immoral. And they know of your values, and they know that you'll violate your moral values, but they're giving you the line of how much they love you. You need to run as far away from that person as you possibly can. They don't love you. If they are willing to violate your faith and your convictions and your character, if they are trying to persuade you to defile yourself with them, that is not godly, that is not righteous, that's not the kind of behavior that's going to please your Lord. But it says something to you about their love for you. Now, let's come along with that to godly husbands. And let me go ahead and say this. I would also say that a godly wife is going to do her all, not to get her husband to do the wrong thing, to get her husband to do the right thing. So submissiveness means I'm still trying. If he's not a Christian, I'm leading him to Christ. 1 Peter 3 talks about that. So that by your behavior, he sees Christ in you. But we're talking about the husbands. And as a husband, a godly husband's desire must be to lead his wife to spiritual purity, which means the following. And this is part of the reason that when you look at this text and you think about the kind of person you're going to marry, that these thoughts need to be circulating around somewhere up there. As a husband, you are not to expose your wife to those things that are impure doctrinally or spiritually or morally. You are to protect her purity to the best of your ability. Now, I've known some situations where, in this case, a wife or a woman was intent on not serving God and was in rebellion to God and had a husband that was trying to get her to do the right thing and she rebelled. But I also know plenty of situations where a husband did not do what he should have done. He did not try to lead his wife in the right way. And if your relationship is causing your wife to become crude or coarse or immoral or hard-hearted or defiling in character, moral fiber is being polluted, that is not being loving. Let me go on and say this. And that is, as we think about this, true love, as unpopular as this idea is, if you are selflessly, sacrificially leading your wife, sometimes means that you need to, as the head of your wife, say, no, that would not be the right thing for you to do. No, that is not the right thing for you to wear. No, we don't need to socially drink. No, we do not need to participate in lascivious dancing. No, we do not need to partake of those things. If you see your wife on a dangerous road spiritually and you say nothing to her, how can she have any trust in you? How can she think for one moment that you truly love her any more than you would think she loves you if she's encouraging you or by her silence is not what she ought to be as far as helping you. Verses 28 through 30. This loving leadership is selfless, sacrificial, sanctifying. It is satisfying. Let's go back to Ephesians 5. Verse 28, he says, So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. I want you to notice what he says. First of all, he says, you're to be a loving provider. This is interesting. He takes us all the way back to the beginning, really. What he is quoting here about the one flesh relationship between a husband and a wife, the unity, the oneness of the marital bond, takes us all the way back to the institution of marriage in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. But let's dig a little bit deeper than that. It takes us back to the institution of the relationship in which God created man and woman and instituted the marriage relationship. But then over there in Matthew 19, when Jesus was asked the question about divorce, and he was giving reasons for the permanence of the marital relationship, he cited also Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. And so here we are in Paul's writing, and he goes back to Genesis 2 and verse 24 and says he is to be a loving provider. A man must strive to provide for his wife, and not just physically. That's kind of a given. We understand that. But spiritually, intellectually, emotionally. In fact, notice the terms. He mentions nourish and cherish. Please look at those words in Ephesians 5. The word nourish here comes from the Greek term ektrepho. And ektrepho, ek means out of, trepho means to feed. And so it's complete feeding, which would include spiritual feeding. It comes from the same Greek word, or root word rather, that we have over in Ephesians 6:4 regarding nurturing our children. It's not to say your wife is a child, but what I'm trying to get you to see is this, the idea of a nurturing feeding. Husbands are to do that. Now that doesn't tend to be always our natural inclination. But this is a provision of a climate where she can spiritually develop. She needs your leadership. She needs you to step up and be a spiritual leader. She needs you to be a provider. She needs you to be a protector. She needs you to be a teacher in your family, in your home. And if you're not doing that, you're not doing what Christ commanded. The term cherish actually has to do with warmth, a gentle love. Look at 1 Corinthians 7 and look at the desire of the husband and the wife for one another. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2, he says, and he's talking about the sexual relationship, but I want you to see the principle governing the sexual relationship. Verse 2, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. The New American Standard Bible renders that as duty. And likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And I'm sure some women go, oh no. But look at the next clause. Everybody accuses Paul of being some kind of chauvinist. This was anti-chauvinism here. Look at the next clause. He applies it the same way to the husband. He says, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. Verse 4. So there's things the wife needs from her husband and he has the obligation of providing. The wife, he says, hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise, also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. And then he says, defraud you, not one the other, except it be with consent. Don't neglect each other. Are you providing for your wife? Are you protecting? Turn to 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Turn to 1 Peter the 3rd chapter. Please notice that passage with me to go along with this. It's a pivotal, critical text. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. Now remember we studied the first 6 verses about Sarah and about Sarah submitting to her husband, and she submitted to her husband out of reverence for God and reverence for him, but it was not a fearful submission. It wasn't that I'm scared so I submit. And submitting itself can be a fearful thing. You have to let go. You have to let go of control. You have to trust your husband and let him lead you. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 7, you husbands, he comes back to the husband. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. The old King James says, with knowledge, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. This is another one where I have been doing wedding ceremonies for people, and I refuse to take it out. If you want to get somebody to take it out, you're going to have to get somebody else to do the wedding ceremony. There's two words everybody gets upset about, usually on the feminine side of things. The word obey, but if you understand obey and what that means, and having a submissive spirit, that shouldn't be a problem. That doesn't mean you obey your husband if he's wrong in asking you to sin or anything like that. But the other word is weaker. Weaker, a weaker vessel. This shows misunderstanding. This is a blessing to you. It is not something that you ought to feel degraded or diminished as a woman. The word weaker can mean something that is derogatory, but it doesn't always mean that. Notice he doesn't say she's weak, it says she's weaker in comparison to a masculine counterpart. Let's go further with this. He's been talking, and I've read this passage for years, and I want you to really get the flow of the context. Look at the end of verse 6. If you do what is right without being frightened by any fear, and then he says, you husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. Have an understanding of what your responsibility is as a husband. Have knowledge of that. Realize what you owe her. Then he says, as with someone that is is weaker. He's not talking about her intellect. He's certainly not talking about spiritually. He's not saying spiritually she's weaker. Galatians 3:28 says that we're all one in Christ. There's neither male nor female. We're all one in Christ. We have different functions, but in our nature, we're equal before God. Your wife is spiritually equal in her nature so far as her standing before God. Now, she is to submit in her function, but that has no bearing on her nature. And so that's not what he's saying. He's not talking about her intellect. He's not talking about spiritually. He's dealing with her submissive role, her sphere. She must submit to you. Don't abuse your authority. That's what he's saying. Lead her in a godly way. Lead her selflessly. Lead her sacrificially. Lead her in the right way. You need to stand up and lead her in the godly way. But don't be ungodly. And so when he mentions the idea of weaker, I think really his idea is vulnerability. She is in need of safety and security and protection from her husband, not abuse. Notice chapter 3 and verse 7. I know she's spiritually equal because he calls her what? A joint heir with Christ. She's a joint heir with you. But let me tell you something, husbands. If you are, and this can happen in a couple of ways. You could be an abusive rather than sacrificial leader. You could be a negligent leader. Either way, you can pick whichever one you want. He says, if that's the case with you, then there is a barrier between your prayers and God. And I don't think he's saying just when you and your wife are praying together. What he's saying is your relationship with God and your relationship with your wife are so integrated, you can't have one and not the other. If you're an ungodly husband, you're not right with God. In fact, she's to be honored by her husband. And then our final point, and I appreciate your good attention, this is a supreme love. Look at verses 31 through 33. We've stayed in Ephesians 5. Let's end there. Ephesians 5, verse 31. Going back to Genesis 2. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Verse 33. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. There's to be leaving and cleaving. And this is why, brethren, fornication, porneia is the term, illicit sexual immorality, is the lone cause and grounds for divorce. That's such a violation of the marital relationship and the leaving and the cleaving and the one flesh relationship that it is a cause for divorce and remarriage. Marriage is such a beautiful relationship. If husbands will lead and wives will submit in love, understanding those concepts, it can be a great blessing to you. And you can be permanent partners, and you can endure and you can persevere and you can cause one another to become closer to God. Before we end, I want to share a story that I found regarding the intimate love and the support, the closeness of a husband and wife, to illustrate to you the value of this kind of love and the lessons that this kind of love will teach us. It teaches us as men what it really means to have that sacrificial love. And it teaches godly women what it means to love, respect, submit, and help and support. Let me read it to you. The person writing this story says, I'm going to tell you about a love story that I witness every time I go to the nursing home to see my husband, who has Alzheimer's disease. Unfortunately, I know firsthand how this terrible illness affects family members, but I would like the world to know what love really is. I see a man who I understand has spent the last 8 years caring for his wife, who has Alzheimer's. They have been married over 50 years. He cooks and feeds her every bite of food she eats. He has bathed her and dressed her every day all those years. I cannot describe the tenderness and the love that this man shows for his wife. She is unable to recognize anyone, including him. The only thing she knows or shows any interest in are two baby dolls. They are never out of her hands. I observed him when I parked my car beside his the other day. He sat in his old pickup truck for a few minutes. Then he patted down what little hair he had, straightened the threadbare collar of his shirt, and looked in the mirror for a final check before going in to see his wife. He said it was as if they were dating again. They have been partners all these years and have seen each other under all kinds of circumstances. Yet he carefully groomed himself before he called on his wife, who wouldn't even know him. Brethren, our society can attack the marriage relationship, but that is a faithful marriage. That is devotion to the very end. And that is the closest thing you can ever do to touch the boundaries and the glorious boundaries of God's everlasting love. And the only thing that you can do to get closer to the Lord than that kind of love is to see Him in eternity. And so I would ask you as a husband, are you doing your best? I would ask you as a wife, are you doing your best? As a father and a mother, are you doing your best? Are you sacrificially leading as you should? Are you lovingly submitting as you should? Are you helping each other go to heaven? That must be your sole desire. If you're not a Christian, we invite you to come to Christ today as together we stand and we sing.